Hello, I'm Richard Ady.
And I'm Kate Pearcey. And this is The Money, RN's new show about economics.
And today we're dealing with blizzards of numbers. Many, many, many numbers. Many, many large numbers.
Well, numbers translated into graphs and meaningful information, surely.
Yeah, that's right. Because in just under a week, next Wednesday, the ABS releases the national accounts for what's called the December quarter, so the last 3 months of last year.
You certainly won't be able to miss it.
Well, there's a lot of media coverage because there's a lot of information. There'll be numbers for terms of trade, so the relationship between the prices of exports and imports. There's national disposable income. There's the household saving ratio. There's a bunch more. And there's the biggie, which is the measure of the size of the economy, the GDP.
They're the one piece of information that give us a sort of one-stop, big picture view of where the economy was at a particular point in time.
Sally Ault is the chief economist and head of fixed income and FX strategy at JP Morgan.
There's a lot of information in the national accounts, and if you're doing a thorough run through, it can take a lot of time. But basically, it tells you where the economy was at. So which parts of the economy were doing well, which were doing not so well. And it's important to understand where the economy was at a certain point as a starting point for your forecast track.
Making predictions about what the economy will do so that investment bank JP Morgan can take positions that will make money is Sally Ault's job. And to do that forecasting, she needs the economic indicators.
The GDP is the big one, but what are the others?
The big ones we get tend to be inflation. That's important, especially for thinking about, you know, where the central bank might be taking monetary policy over the next sort of 6 to 12 months. In Australia, we're a little bit unusual because we only get the inflation numbers once a quarter. Most other jurisdictions get monthly inflation numbers, so we're a little bit different in that respect. But it does mean that they are very important for markets' perceptions of, you know, what the RBA may or may not do next. So that would be another big one. Labour market data is probably the next biggest indicator that comes once a month, in the sense that often the unemployment rate is a very good measure of how much slack or excess capacity there is in the economy, and that's what ultimately determines inflation, which is ultimately what determines the setting of monetary policy. So the labour market numbers are important, very volatile, but important nonetheless.
Well, we had those last week, of course.
And the seasonally adjusted unemployment rate for January is at exactly 6%, which is up a teensy bit from last year. But there is concern about the quality of the data. Both Glenn Stevens, Governor of the RBA, and John Fraser, Treasury Secretary, have expressed concern about the accuracy of the labour market figures.
And that's not all. Sally Ault says there's also another completely different issue with the biggest indicator of all, the GDP.
The problem is that it does get revised a lot. So if you think about the mechanics of putting together a GDP number, a lot of the information you have to go and survey people. So you, for example, if you were doing a renovation on your house, you might be surveyed to say, look, we know from your local council that you guys are doing a renovation. How much do you think you've spent on that renovation this quarter? Now, not everyone does the right thing and sends the form back on time. They might send it back 3 months later, which means there's additional information to be incorporated. So that's also the other tricky aspect to GDP, which is that it is prone to sometimes quite significant revisions, either up or down.
This gets us to something else. We're talking about people here. I don't know about you, Kate, but I forget things, I lose things. If something's not in the diary, it might as well not exist.
I just play everything by ear.
And I suppose it's that human nature that Greg McKenna is interested in. He's a contributing editor at Business Insider, and he's a bit of a behavioural economist.
Essentially, what behavioural economists and behavioural finance people do is we look at what people do as normal human beings rather than the rational actors that economic theory says that we are. So we know that humans don't always make rational decisions. We know that markets don't always make rational decisions. And so what behavioural finance and economics guys do is we account for that when we're looking at how markets and how economies work.
Right. So you understand that we're human.
Absolutely. And that's what makes economics fun, is that when you learn it at uni or you do it at high school, it's all about numbers and all the boring stuff and formulas, but it's people that make up the economy, and people are interesting. And when you look at the way people interact and the way they react to stimuli, then you can get a much better understanding of what's actually going to happen in the economy.
How does that affect the economic indicators?
Well, just like you heard before with the GDP, where people don't get back to the ABS in time. But it also means something else. You can be a bit lateral about what an economic indicator is.
What, like a boiled egg index?
I don't know about boiled eggs, but Greg did ask me to meet him in a cafe because there's a cafe index.
Yes, it's one of my favourite indexes. I was the treasurer of a small regional bank during the GFC, and one of the things that I noticed was through our balance sheet and also through the retail sales numbers that we saw from the Australian Bureau of Statistics that cafe and restaurant sales were going up and down and up and down from month to month. So one month they'd grow, the next month they wouldn't. And what that was telling me was it was telling me that in many ways, Australians at that time, with all the fear of the GFC, worries about unemployment, worries about what was happening in the share market, they were caving. They were only going out to cafes and restaurants when they could afford it. And so they'd save the money, go out, you'd see a spike, and then they wouldn't go out the next month, they'd flatline or go backwards, and then they'd go out again the next month. So that to me was a really good indicator of what Australians were feeling. And you could see that in retail sales overall. You could see that in the balance sheet of the bank. I could see more cash coming onto the balance sheet. So that's become my favourite indicator for what Australians are feeling. And when I start to see retail sales continue to grow, then I'll know the Australian economy has made that transition.
But the cafe index, it's a thing, is it?
Yeah, it is a thing. It's my thing. It's certainly something that we look at. You know, anecdotally, people can see, you know, how long the queue is for the coffee in the morning, how busy it is at lunchtime and all that kind of stuff. But the ABS numbers give those anecdotes some real power and some real influence because they back up your intuition.
If you can have a cafe index, why stop there?
Oh, we're just getting started. Do you wear lipstick?
If I'm feeling kissy, Richard?
Well, I don't know about an index for kissiness, but there's an index for lipsticks.
Everybody deserves a little treat, or everybody wants to spoil themselves. And what the lipstick index really is that when the economy's a little bit weaker than maybe people want it to be, when they're worried about employment or they're worried about the mortgage or that sort of thing, well, women and men who want to treat their wives or their girlfriends will buy a small luxury. And that's what the lipstick index really picks up on. It picks up on the fact that we all need to treat ourselves every now and again. And in a reverse way, it can tell us that the economy is a bit flatter than perhaps what people think. You know, lipstick sales go up or those kind of things. And, you know, you can speak to David Jones or Priceline or whoever to find out the data. But they'll tell you a lot about where the economy is.
Actually, I'm feeling a little financially stressed, Richard. I think I'll just nip out and buy a new lippy.
Well, just stay there for now, because there's more. There's a bloke's version of the lipstick index, only it's the inverse of lipstick, so the other way around. It's the men's underwear index.
That's one that came out of the US. I think it was either Ben Bernanke or one of the senior guys at the Fed. And what they were looking at was that sales of men's underwear go down during times of economic downturns. And effectively, that's, I guess, because most blokes aren't in a hurry to go out and buy underwear anyway, but they're less pressured to do so by their wives or girlfriends or whoever when money's a little bit tighter.
Right, so this is a derivation of something else. It's a derivation of spousal pressure.
Absolutely. All these kind of indicators are, in a certain sense, derived, and it's important to note that anecdotes aren't evidence necessarily, but when you stack them up and you put a few of these indicators together, you really can get a good sense of what's going on in the economy.
I'm intrigued as to how you measure the underwear index. It's because I certainly wouldn't want to go around asking people about it.
Well, I'm guessing that it came from the Fed, so the Fed would go around to Macy's and JCPenney and those kind of guys and say, how is this? But also, there's so many analysts in the world these days, and equity analysts and those kind of guys, that they can really dig into the data that you get from retail sales, from corporate announcements and those kind of things, and that's where these things pop up.
It's all very well, these indexes about cafes and lipsticks and undies, even if the last two do strike me as a little bit sexist somehow. But I can see how millions of purchasing decisions add up to something that gives us information about the economy. But it's still small fry, isn't it, compared to the really big investments or delays on those big investments?
Yeah, I wondered about that too. But Greg and I were sitting at the cafe and he got me to look out the window, and what I could see was cranes.
The crane index for Australia is a really important one. What it does is it captures construction in the economy, and construction is not a massive part of the economy, you know, 5 or 10% in many ways. But what it does is it tells you about what's happening in the underlying economy. So if you think that, you know, let's say there's 100,000 or 200,000 direct people working, building things, well, there'll be three or four times that fitting them out. And when we look at these cranes here building the new centre at Darling Harbour, that's infrastructure. That's exactly what the Australian economy needs. So when you do see cranes being built, you know that construction workers are being employed. From an Australian point of view, this was a necessary part of the economic transition, because a lot of workers that were building iron ore mines or the Gorgon or those kind of things, they're now building this. And so that was part of the transition. And that's why the Reserve Bank dropped rates to get housing construction going. And that's why infrastructure is an important part of government policies, particularly here in New South Wales.
Well, while we're on building and cranes, what we can't see from here, because it's just our angle is interrupted by trees, are any skyscrapers. But there is a skyscraper index, isn't there?
The skyscraper index is a cracker. Basically, there's a theory that says each time somebody announces that there is going to be the world's tallest building, skyscraper, whether it's office or residential, that's normally a period when the market peaks. Now, coincidentally, we did have one of those towards the end of 2015, somewhere in the Middle East. I don't exactly remember where, but it was a classic sign that it's just a sign of excess. When people feel like they have to build the biggest something, then the skyscraper index is a great one. It's a bit like the magazine cover index for, talking about stocks go up or property goes to the moon, those kind of things. They're anecdotal, but they're powerful.
So what we're seeing there is it's kind of a measure of hubris.
Oh, completely. It's absolutely a measure of hubris. And that's the key thing about why the behavioural approach to economics can really help, particularly in a market sense. Because what happens is you go through these stages you're worried, then you feel comfortable, then you're really hot on something, and then that's when you take risks that you shouldn't have taken. That's when banks finance deals that would never have stacked up in a normal market. That's when you get people doing silly things. That's when markets break down. That's when economies get into trouble because of markets.
Actually, I think there are plans to build a new skyscraper in Tokyo, which, if it goes ahead, will be almost twice as big as the world's tallest building in Dubai. Maybe that's not a good sign.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to think about that. This is The Money, RN's economics show, and I'm Richard Aidy. Next week, the national accounts come out for the fourth quarter of last year. Because of all this, The Money's producer Kate Piercy and I are trying to get to grips with economic indicators.
So far, we've heard about the big indicators like unemployment and inflation and the GDP, which sometimes has to be adjusted. And Greg McKenna has just been telling us about some of the more unusual indicators. They don't have the rigour of the big ones, but they do provide a quick and dirty measure because they capture human behaviour.
The other thing to say about all of these indicators, whether they're more interesting, like the lipstick index, or more official, like employment figures, is that they fit into one of three categories. They're either lagging or current or leading.
So GDP is obviously lagging. The data comes from the fourth quarter of last year. And lagging indicators enable people like Sally Auld from JP Morgan to confirm their models. What about current indicators? What do they do?
They're telling you the sort of underlying pulse of the economy at any point in time. So that would be things like the employment numbers, retail sales, consumer confidence, business confidence. So they're giving you a read on what's happening right now. So the health of the business sector, the health of the consumer sector. They're important too, in the sense that we think the economy might be doing one thing, and then often the data will tell you something quite different. Or getting the sort of sense of a trend emerging in those data is important too. So it might be that, you know, retail sales has been very strong. If that strength is starting to fade, you know, are we starting to see the household sector pull back? What does that mean? So it's sort of where the number is on the day to give you a sense of how the household sector is going, but then it's also putting it in context relative to where we've been in the last 6 months and where we think we're going as well.
Now, what about the leading indicators? Because this is something you hear about a fair bit. This is, I suppose, indicators that will tell us where we're going.
That's exactly right. And for a forecaster, you love leading indicators. They're really important. So one of the more relevant ones we have at the moment is building approvals. So, for example, you know, if you want to build a new house or you're a developer building an apartment block, you have to put in an application to council that will get approved. That counts as a building approval. That will give you a forward read on what construction activity is going to do, and construction activity is a part of GDP. So that's a very leading indicator, building approvals. There are parts of the consumer confidence survey that give you a good read on consumption volumes. So, for example, there's a series that measures how you feel about your family finances versus a year ago, and that gives you a good read on what consumption will do over the next 3 to 6 months. So as an economist, it's great when you find good leading indicators, because that makes the forecasting process, you know, less difficult than it might otherwise be.
To get an edge, Sally Auld is looking at a lot of different indices, some more useful than others, some more reliable than others. And actually, there's one really important indicator that she believes could be better, or at least that we should see more of.
I think inflation is one where most economists in Australia would argue it would be great to have monthly inflation readings. You know, as we were talking about before, Australia is very much out of sync, I guess, with best practice in that regard, and that, you know, every other sort of G10 country has monthly inflation indicators. And I think the RBA, given that the inflation targeting aspect to what they do is so fundamental and so critical to them, they're strongly of the opinion that it would be a good idea too. The problem is that it obviously costs more money to survey prices once a month, every month, than it does to do it once a quarter or every 3 months. And so it's really about, you know, the economists' sort of favourite constrained optimization problem, in the sense that the ABS has a certain budget, and then we've got to determine, you know, what do we think the best way is to spend that budget. That budget's not infinite. So there will be, you know, we might get better data on retail and less better on inflation, but it's, you know, you're always, it's a trade-off. You're always choosing one over the other.
So Australian data would be better if we updated inflation more often. But what about other countries? How good are they at this? World Economics, a London-based organisation that analyses exactly what you'd imagine, has been looking at global GDP data and ranked 154 countries from best to worst. So who came where? Well, the woman behind the Data Quality Index, that's what it's called, is Dariana Tani.
We have in the index that Switzerland and the US come at the top of the list, where areas Haiti and Sudan come at the bottom. And this is essentially because these countries are using old-fashioned methodologies. For example, Haiti is using a 1986 base year to measure the GDP calculations. And Sudan is using a 1981 base year to measure the GDP calculations. And they have using the 1968 United States System of National Accounts. So that is why we really find discrepancies, and we cannot rely on the data because these countries are using old-fashioned methodologies.
Mm. Out of interest, Dariana, how does Australia do in this index?
Australia is in the 12th position, just behind Canada and ahead of Finland.
Dariana Tani from World Economics. If we come home now and look forward to next week, when Australia's latest GDP is released, what would be a good number? Sally Auld.
I think people are pretty happy with the idea that the economy, you know, has been undergoing this transition where we've had this huge terms of trade surge. We're now unwinding that. We've seen that happen on the price side. So commodity prices have come off a lot. And we know that mining investment is starting to unwind. We're about half of the way through that process. As that transition takes place, it's very difficult to get the economy to grow at trend or above trend rate. So most people's expectation is that in year-ended terms, the economy should be somewhere around 2.5%. That's probably an okay result. If we get something that's closer to 3, that would be definitely an upside surprise. And then if we got a number like that, then we'd say, well, you know what, the labour market data actually makes sense. Those two pieces now fit together. If we're getting GDP outcomes that show the economy grew, you know, maybe something closer to sort of 0.4, 0.5, and we annualise that and it's sort of a 2% run rate, that's great in global terms. Like most other policymakers would say, 2% growth, I'll take that any day. For Australia, that feels a bit sick.
Well, let's hope it doesn't get to that, because if we do, the financial markets will have a bit of a tanty. Thanks to Sally Auld from JP Morgan, Dariana Tani from World Economics, and Greg McKenna from Business Insider for walking us through that. I'm Kate Piercy.
I'm Richard Ady, and this is The Money, RN's economics show.